Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Streaming countrywide on Prime Media Plus.
On DSTV channel 885.
And across the city.
On 567 AM.
Oi, it's time for my man, Chris Smith, Dr. Chris Smith, lecturer at the University of Cambridge, the Naked Scientist, our very own Naked Scientist, and he's going to answer all your questions. Welcome to the Naked Scientist. Great to have you back.
Morning, Clarence. You know, I saw a great story in the paper this week. I don't know if you saw this, that the gentleman, Paul Alexander, who was 78 years old, has just died. He spent almost his entire life in an iron lung. The iron lung being the device that helped to keep people who got paralysis of their respiratory muscles because of polio alive. Most people didn't manage to survive that long. He managed to train as a lawyer, even turned up in court, not in his iron lung, but at temporarily out of it in a wheelchair for a few hours he could manage each day. But he turned what would be a devastating disease and a devastating outcome into a successful and well-lived life. And I think this is a useful story because it reminds us that in the 1950s, when there were epidemics of polio in many countries all around the world and hundreds of thousands of cases, we're now down to handfuls of cases in just a couple of places. There's still polio circulating in Pakistan and in Afghanistan, but most countries now, thanks to enormous efforts of vaccination and therefore the success of science, have almost eradicated what was once a really, really, really dread disease for hundreds of thousands of people. And I think it's an amazing triumph, but we are almost there. Let's hope that we can now get this over the hill and eradicate this for good.
What's the objective there, Doc? Is the objective eternal life?
Well, the thing is that we want to have the best health span. People often think about how long you want to live, but there's no point in living if you're not living, as one elderly person put it to me. If you're not healthy, then you can't enjoy life to the same extent you can when you are healthy. So the idea is, can we shift people's health span, the way that they have good quality, enjoyable, functional life, as long as possible, so that you may not live any longer, but the years you do have are healthy ones. And that's really the goal of medicine, is to make people not just live longer, but to live happier, healthier lives, so they're more productive and able to enjoy what they're doing for a greater proportion of the time they have on Earth.
Yeah. I wonder if people even have the aspiration of eternal life. With all the stupid people in the world, I most certainly don't want eternal life. I don't think I've got the energy for it, frankly. But let's move on. Plenty of questions for you. Lots via WhatsApp. Plenty of voice notes. Let's go there, Joe.
Question for the doctor. I was wondering if, you know, the rate at which your nails are growing, if it differs from men to women, or does it differ? Is it also affected by the food that you eat, or maybe the temperature? Or summer and winter. If the doctor can just please explain or maybe talk to us about that. George MacDonald from Stellenbosch.
Thank you, George.
Hello, George. Well, fingernails and toenails grow slowly, and they do grow at slightly different rates in the same person. So your toenails grow slightly slower than your hand fingernails. Fingernails, few millimetres a month. Toenails, 1 millimetre a month, thank goodness, or you'd be down there trying to chop them all the time. Fingernails probably grow a bit faster from an evolutionary point of view because you're using your fingers all the time to manipulate things. Fingernails are very useful for that, but they therefore wear down faster, so you grow them a bit faster. They're made of the same stuff your hair is, keratin, it's protein, and therefore they're also going to grow at the rate dictated by the nutritional status of you as a person. So if you're malnourished, if you're not eating properly, or if you have some kind of disease that means you can't absorb calories properly, you're in negative nitrogen balance, you're breaking down your proteins, or you're ill for other reasons, toenail and fingernail growth will arrest or slow down. And if you look in people who've had serious illnesses, even more trivial illnesses sometimes, they will show you their fingernails and they'll say, what are these lines? And you can see lines, almost like tide marks, across each of the fingers, in the same place on each of the fingers, and these grow out with time. And this is the high watermark for that person's illness, which arrested the growth of the fingernail temporarily or slowed it down, so the characteristic shape of the nail changed temporarily at that point. And it's, you can see in people who have, for instance, chemotherapy for cancer or for other sorts of diseases like bone marrow cancers, you see this in their fingernails. And the same thing happens with hair. And so there is a difference in people's general health and nutritional status. It's also asked about the difference between men and women. Well, everyone's different, and some people will have toenails and fingernails that grow slightly faster, some slightly slower. But on average, the average person's nails grow a few millimetres a month on their hands and about 1 millimetre a month on their feet.
We have another voice note in. Let's take a listen, Joe.
I've got a question for the Dr. Chris. When we get injured or superficial, like skin wound or something like that, the body produces histamine around the wound, and that is something that causes people to want to scratch. It produces an itch. So the question is, why is it that we have evolved like that? What is the evolutionary reason for the body producing a substance which causes people to want to take an action that will be bad for the healing of the wound? I understand the biology of why that we produce the histamine and why it causes an itch, but what is the reason that we've evolved to develop this function in our body that seems to be counter-evolutionary, and, you know, left to our own devices, we delay the healing by scratching the wound? I hope that question makes sense. Thanks.
It sure does, and thanks for that. What a great point. It seems totally counterintuitive. Why do we have these mechanisms that seem to irritate us, excuse the pun, when in reality I'd much rather get on with my life and just let my body heal up? It's really all about drawing your attention to the problem, isn't it? If you have something that's painful, you tend to guard it and you tend to use it less. If you have something that's itchy, it tells you that something else is wrong with that bit of the body. It's a different sensation to pain, so it gives you an extra dimension to being able to draw your attention to a body part and then focus on doing something about it. The evolved mechanism is histamine comes from mast cells, which are big cells that sit in all of the tissues where we're exposed to the outside world. And they're crammed full, these mast cells, of granules of histamine. And when you perturb one of those cells, which can happen because you prod them, it can happen because of chemical stimulation, other injury, or when substances lock onto antibodies that are bound to those cells and then tell the cell something's going wrong, discharge your histamine. The cells are like policemen that are in the layers where we're exposed to potential threats. So they sound the initial burglar alarm. Something is damaging the skin in this region. This itch sensation draws your attention to that area. It could be a parasite trying to get through your skin. It could be something you've put on your skin which you're allergic to, etc. So it's telling you it's the skin that's a problem here. Pay attention to it. So it gives you extra information. And the role of the histamine isn't just to make you itch, which it does by activating an itch-specific group of nerve fibers that feed back to your spinal cord and say, this patch of the body where this sensation is coming from, the itch signal is also on. Therefore, that's itchy. And it makes you scratch it because then you're paying attention to it. But also by scratching it, you activate nerve endings that signal pain, and pain turns off itch. So that's how the system works. But it also means that when the histamine is there, you have other defenses that are invoked. Histamine opens up blood vessels, so you augment the blood flow to the region that's affected. And histamine also opens up the links between blood vessel cells, making blood vessels leakier. And if you increase the gaps between the cells in the walls of the small blood vessels, then proteins, like antibodies, like the other proteins that are used to fight infection, can come out from the blood and get into the tissue, and also cells of the immune system that flock to the area because they hear the histamine alarm, they can get in more easily as well. So it's a whole clever system which has some aspects of it that you need to know about consciously, which is why it tells you, and other aspects which happen subconsciously to help other elements of your body with the healing process, because the immune response coming in causes acute inflammation, release of growth factors, supply of cells to help remove infection and other inflammatory material that would impair the healing process, and then ultimately you get better. But I agree with you. It does feel quite irritating when you're scratching, thinking, if this didn't itch, I wouldn't scratch it and my skin would heal up easier. You have to exert a little bit of mental control over that element of it. But the rest of it's quite a wonderful machine, really.
Our interaction with the Naked Scientist every Friday after 9:30. You're welcome to post your questions via WhatsApp, 0725671567. Your calls anytime, 0214460567. Denise in Tableview, you call that number. You're welcome. Go ahead for the Naked Scientist.
Thank you. I'd like to know, when they do the PCR test to test for COVID, why did they shove the swab up your nose instead of swabbing your mouth like they do for DNA?
Ah, Denise, hello. Well, the reason for this, and in fact, people do both a throat swab and a nose swab for some of these COVID tests. The SARS-CoV-2 virus is a coronavirus. That's the one that causes COVID-19, the disease. This is a respiratory infection, and it infects cells throughout the respiratory tract, but has a penchant for the cells which are in your nose, right at the top of your nose, and especially the ones that subserve the sense of smell, which is why some people, when they catch or get a dose of COVID early on, they often say one of the first signs is they lose their sense of smell. And if you want your PCR test to have the best chance of picking up the cause of why you're not feeling or the ticket, then you go to where the action is. You go to the epicenter of the infection, at least initially, and the nose is relatively accessible, and you can therefore stand a higher chance of sweeping up some material that will contain virus particles or the debris from virus particles, and that will contain the nucleic acids, which are the effective instructions for that virus, which the PCR test can pick up. Your mouth contains all kinds of horrible stuff, loads of cells and saliva, and there's going to be a greater degree of dilution. So the sensitivity, if you just use the mouth, isn't necessarily as high as if you go for the nose where the action is.
And then we have this question in from Dupi. Dupi's out in Hermanus. Question for the wise doctor. Why does the remote of my gate motor work better when I hold it against my head while pressing the button? At times, the motor doesn't respond, but works once I hold that remote against my head. Here's an interesting one.
Yeah, we get this from time to time, people asking this, and one has to be really careful about this being a story that improves in the telling. Someone says, well, my remote control didn't seem to work, so I held it against my head, and then it did. And then everyone thinks, ah, that's the goal. That's how it works. So I'll do that. And the one time it does work, they remember, and the 99% of the time that it didn't work, they don't. So you've got to be really careful to attaching significance to a coincidence in this circumstance. Possible reasons why it might make a difference. If you think about where you would hold the remote when you just get it out of your pocket, you'd probably hold it at waist height. This may not be as close to the receiver as head height. So by elevating it above the ground to where your head is, you're actually reducing the distance from the transmitting device to the receiving device. And because the strength of the signal is very sensitive to distance, if it's just about wavering on working and you reduce that distance a tiny amount, it might just make the difference between working and not working. So that could be an explanation. And a more outlandish explanation one of my engineering friends once put forward was, well, one other possibility is that you could be conceivably turning your body into part of the antenna system by having the device coupled onto you, and you might therefore increase the transmitting surface area that might help to propagate the signals a bit better. But he was sceptical about that and suggested that the aforementioned height above the ground is probably a more reasonable, more plausible explanation for why this might work.
Ding dong. Light bulb moment. Let's go for a voice note. Joe, what have you got for us?
Good morning, Clarence and Dr. Smith there, Flora Shifa Booster. Dr. Smith, please. Can you please explain to me snoring? Where does snoring come from and how can one cure it? My wife is a snorer of note, and it sometimes gets extremely annoyed. Even our dog Brutus in the living room on his couch is growling at night, getting annoyed with my wife snoring. And I hope no one is going to tell her that, because I don't want to end up next to Brutus tonight. But yeah, snoring, how can one cure it and where does it come from?
Snoring happens at the back of your throat, and the airway that comes up from the lungs, the trachea, opens into your throat, your pharynx, at a region called the laryngeal inlet, Above that is the epiglottis, which is the patch of tissue that guides things going down your throat around the laryngeal inlet so you don't accidentally inhale your lunch. And then above that is your mouth. And surrounding all of that is soft tissue, which is supported by muscles, elastic tissue and connective tissue. And as we get older, and especially as we put on weight, then you tend to get more pressure on less elastic tissue because things become floppier as we become older. And this can make some of the elastic tissue at the back of the throat that would normally be there to hold the airway open sag. And if you couple that to the fact that a person who might be carrying a bit too much weight often sleeps on their back as well, this can push down on everything and make things flop back into the path of the air. So as you're breathing out, you push the soft tissue out of the way, because pushing it out of the way is relatively easy. But when you try and breathe in, what happens is that because all the soft tissue has flopped into the way of the path of the air, in fact, it's like a flap valve, and the air coming in pushes against the floppy tissue and closes the gap down even more. So you then get more resistance to the airflow, you get turbulent flow, and that's what the rasping noise is. And people often end up with a period where they'll slowly struggle to get more and more air in until they then splutter and kind of clear their airway themselves, partially waking themselves up, and then they'll carry on snoring normally again. So the reason is that it's down to floppy tissue at the back of the throat. There are a number of ways to treat this. One of them is to look at your general health and try and improve that. Another may be posture, and also getting some advice. If it's beginning to affect a person's ability to sleep or their partner's ability to sleep, and you're suffering from headaches, tiredness, poor function during the day, can also affect people's mood, obviously, and even the dog's mood. If that's beginning to be the problem, you should definitely get some advice from a sleep specialist who might be able to give some hints and tips. Also take a look and make sure there's not some other important anatomical reason why this is happening, and then also get you some way towards getting it managed so that you get a better night's sleep, and so does your partner.
Barris in Bloberg has a fascinating question. Let's listen.
Yeah, morning, Chris. Morning, Chris. I'm just curious to know, if a plane took off from London and went up, pretty much in a straight line down to Cape Town, while it's in the air, does the Earth's rotation speed have on where the plane ultimately could end up? Or can it fly in a straight line without being affected by it, by the speed of the Earth?
Right, okay. A slightly dodgy line, but the thrust of the argument is, you take off from a planet that's spinning, and you fly somewhere else on the surface of that spinning planet, well, why do you end up in the place you were going to? Why doesn't the planet turn round and you just stay where you are? Well, the reason is that if you do a simple experiment, this will reveal the explanation more clearly than I can explain it, which is fill a basin in your bathroom with a little bit of water and spin your hand round in it, and the water begins to move because your hand is moving. Now, your hand is like the Earth. The Earth is spinning inside a big blanket of atmosphere. And so as the Earth spins, it slowly drags the atmosphere around with it until the atmosphere has caught up. And like the water swirling in your hand basin with your hand at the same rate, the atmosphere is spinning with the Earth. So when you take off, you're turning because you are on the Earth's surface and you have that angular momentum. You go into atmosphere that's spinning and has that angular momentum, and then you correct for crosswinds and things like that as you go, because all pilots have to adjust their course. You can't just take off, go in a straight line and hope to get there. You do have to obviously make active adjustments, because at different layers of the altitude there are different wind speeds in different directions. But with all that taken into account, you will arrive where you end up, where you hope to end up, because the atmosphere is moving. Now, the exception to that is if you fly east-west, west-east, there are slight differences in flight times, because you are either going with the moving atmosphere or fighting against it. That does make a difference to flight times, but that's the general reason why you take off. And if you just tried to stay still, you wouldn't suddenly find the planet had turned all the way around underneath you, and then you just landed again in a different place. That's why that doesn't happen.
Okay, we can squeeze this one in as well. How does a colour printer produce all the different colours from one canister of print powder? Marion in Sunningdale with that question.
Hi, Marion. Well, actually, what they do is to use a cartridge that's got multiple different pigments in it. In the old days, you had to buy different cartridges of different colours, usually red, green and blue, or they actually use some combination, which enables them to then use the same trick that a television does effectively, where it's using combinations of colours in tiny dots, which when your eye sees them, just as certain famous artists back in history knew, you see the colour you see is the combination of the colours of the two dots put close together. And so the laser printer will print tiny dots of the different colours it's got from its single cartridge, because there are separate spaces in that single cartridge which have got different coloured inks in it. It will spurt little tiny droplets next to each other, so when your eye sees the red droplet, the green droplet and the blue droplet all close together, it actually sees a sort of whiter patch. And when it sees red and green next to each other, it sees a brownie patch, for example. And that's how it works.
And that's where we're going to have to wrap things for today. A big thank you to the Naked Scientist. Every Friday, make that an appointment just after 9:30. Bring your questions along, and we'll have those ding-dong epiphanies that come with that interaction.